There was a time, even within the compass of my own ministry, when if you were to be preaching on Gideon, you would have been able to assume that most people in the congregation would have known the story of Gideon, and the preacher wouldn't have had to consume all that energy and all that time in reading great chunks of three different chapters. But nowadays I fear even among Christians that these marvelous stories of the Old Testament are not known, and therefore we've had to take the time to read not all the story by any means. We missed out some of the exciting bits, but there is the story, and that is the story that is taken up by the Spirit of God and the writer of the letter to the Hebrews in chapter 11 at verse 32, where he says, "What more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets." And then there's a dash, and he goes on to speak in general terms about the men and women of faith. And when we come to that 32nd verse of Hebrews chapter 11, the writer is very aware of the fact that he cannot possibly go right through the Old Testament adding endlessly to the list of the heroes and the heroines of the faith. And that is why he just makes some brief mention of some of them. And when I began my preparation for this service, I just wondered if perhaps at the point when the writer to the Hebrews had reached that stage in chapter 11, that the Spirit of God brought into his mind the very last verse of the Gospel according to St. John, where it says, "There are also many other things which Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. And if all the stories were told in full, and if all the sermons and these heroes of faith were preached in full, there just wouldn't be enough time to do it." And I'm very aware of the fact that I mustn't make this series of studies in Hebrews chapter 11 too long, and yet I believe that we have to recognize that these characters in the Old Testament, named and not named, have so much to teach us about the life of faith. And some of those who have much to teach us are not named at all. Someone, for example, like Elijah. And I can't help wishing that he had been mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, because we are very often like Elijah. We can feel so small. We can feel at times a remnant of one, and we can feel such failures in the work and witness of God that we can be tempted to give the whole thing up. And what we have to see in all these marvelous stories is this. We have to see God making use of fallible, frail, complicated characters. And every single one of them, Gideon included, were like that. Very, very few of them were promising characters at the beginning of their lives. Perhaps Abraham, he was a pretty big character, but apart from him, not many of them would have been impressive. And yet it was people like that that God laid hold upon. And when we come, after a whole lot of detailed references, when we come to that 32nd verse, "Time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets," the Holy Spirit names for us four of the judges. David, the first king, and then he goes back to Samuel, and then just generalizes and speaks about the prophets. And I think what we have to see here before we go any further is that right down the course of history, not just in the past, but in the present, right down through the course of history, in a variety of different circumstances, we see the men and women of faith. God's prepared and placed men. Nothing accidental about it, nothing fortuitous about it. Men prepared by God, set in their place by God, ready to be used by God at the time that God has ordained. Does it not say in the book of the Acts of the Apostles, the 14th chapter, that God does not leave himself without a witness? And that's true. And some, perhaps we should say, many of God's chosen witnesses were very unexpected and unlikely characters. Even some of them who turned out to be mighty men were at the beginning very, very unexpected. And I'm thinking particularly here in the New Testament of Saul of Tarsus, the university scholar, the religious scholar, the philosopher. The man who was totally obsessed with an antichrist spirit. A man who put the fear of death into the whole of the early apostolic church. To such an extent that when eventually he was converted, the church, the apostolic church, could only with great difficulty be persuaded to accept him. Who would ever have thought that Saul of Tarsus, that frightening persecutor of Christ, would become one of the greatest of the apostles? Now the thing about all these men was their faith. That's the emphasis in Hebrews chapter 11. It wasn't their personality. It wasn't their intellect. It wasn't their capacities and their gifts and all that kind of thing. It wasn't their background or their pedigree. These things are largely irrelevant. It was their faith. As we said last Sunday evening, it was faith in the God who was there. And still he is nigh, his presence we have. And when we are called to have faith, we are called to have faith on the God who is here. Mind you, if he's not here, we might as well all go home. This is a totally futile exercise if God is not here. And faith would become fiction. Faith is faith in the God who is there. The God who is working. The God who is carrying his purposes forward. Oh, let me quote the line again. God ruleth on high, almighty to save, and still he is nigh, his presence we have. Oh, my dear people, think of it like this. When you're really up against it in the course of your daily life, you're not asked to have faith in a God who is far away. You are asked to have faith in the God who is nearer to you than you can possibly measure or imagine. Oh, you say, preacher, that makes faith a bit easier. Of course it does. And it makes unbelief rather stupid. And we have to learn faith, and we have to learn, and we have to be thrilled by, and we have to be amazed at what God can do with unpromising material. You may say, oh, preacher, unpromising material, that's me. Well, there's just no limit to what God can do. I found the line of a hymn going through my mind when I was preparing. What he's done for others, he'll do for you. And then I recalled something that was quoted to me. It's from a little booklet called Windows of Prayer, and this is produced by the deaconesses of the deaconess movement in the Church of Scotland to celebrate their centenary. And some pages, there's very, very little on the pages, and this particular page is 1, 2, 3, 4 lines of print, and they're not even very long. And it's headed, A Word of Encouragement. And it says, one tiny fragment stands out from my years of training at St. Colm's. That's the Church of Scotland Training College in Edinburgh. It was from our study of the book of Jonah in the Revised Standard Version. Quote, God appointed a worm, end quote. And the comment is added, if he could use a worm to fulfill his purpose, he could use me. I like that. And of course, being the kind of fellow I am, I had to go back to the story of Jonah. And sure enough, there it was in Jonah chapter 4 verse 7, God appointed a worm. And then I went back to Jonah chapter 1 at verse 17 and I read there that God prepared a fish. And I found myself thinking of sometimes in these fishmonger shops and you see a whole lot of ungutted fish lying there in the slab with their glazed eyes. God appointed a fish. And in chapter 4 verse 6 of Jonah, God prepared or appointed a plant. God appointed a worm. And God appointed Gideon. And what a complicated character Gideon was. Now all this that we say is making some of you smile, and rightly so. I smiled when I heard it as well. But there's something very important here, because nowadays, especially I think in the church, and especially I think in the evangelical church, there is a great preoccupation with gifts, human gifts and spiritual gifts. And if we hear, oh, some very, very, very brainy professor has said on the television that he's a Christian, oh, great, a professor, oh, won't that be doesn't follow. It says in the New Testament, not many mighty are called. God has chosen the foolish things of the world. We are far too preoccupied with gifts and capacities and intellect and personality and spiritual gifts for that matter. And we get preoccupied at times with too much, I think, with thinking about opportunities and about circumstances. And I come across people who say to me quite earnestly, if only public opinion was changed, there would be more response to the gospel. Oh, now, if circumstances were just easier, or if there were more men, or if only there was some great leader. As I quoted a moment ago from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26, not many mighty are called, not many noble. God has chosen the weak things of the world. And he chose someone like Gideon. Think of the character studies that we've had on Sunday evenings over a spell of time. And then come down to the stories that we'll read about in the book of Judges. Would you change places with any of them? Well, I would say yes in terms of their successes, but no in terms of the cost of these successes. I was speaking just that last week to a minister, an evangelical minister who has a great deal of experience of visiting different congregations as part of committees from presbytery. And he said to me after one particular visit, "I think I'll stick to my own congregation." And the story of the judges brings us to the story of Gideon. Mind you, Barak should really come before Gideon. Well, that's how it is in the book of Judges. But it's not for me to argue with the Holy Spirit, who puts Gideon first in the list of the judges. And the story of the judges brings us to that point of history after the story of Joshua and the conquest of the land, the conquest of Canaan. And after all that tremendous success, the people of God began to turn aside from God. And we read in Judges chapter 2 verse 11, "The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were round about them and bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the power of their enemies round about, so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was..." Oh, they had all sorts of ventures in the name of the Lord. "But whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had warned and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in sore straits." And this was the kind of situation that Gideon and the people found themselves in. It's really very alarming. It's the story of a people who had been blessed by God, who had been prospered by God, and who had rejoiced in God, and who had been victorious in God. And then there came a spiritual landslide. I sometimes wonder what you think about when I'm preaching, but I find what I've just said very disturbing. That a people and a work so richly blessed could so quickly slide into spiritual disaster. And in a situation of disaster like that, after sometimes quite a number of years, sometimes as many as 40 years, God would raise a deliverer, and he would restore his people and restore his work. And then there would come another lapse. As soon as things became easy. I say that this disturbs me because we have things much easier now in Sandyford than we had 20 years ago. And I'm not at all sure that we're the better Christians as a result. I preach these sermons to myself, you know, when I'm doing my sermon preparation. And I went back to the long psalm, Psalm 119. And I read there in verse 67, "Before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now I keep thy word." And in verse 71, "It is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn thy statutes." And it was when the people of God were having things easy because of the mercy of God and because of the ministry of the judges who brought them out of the morass of their failure and reestablished them. And things were easy and they slid. And this brings us to Gideon. In the story in the book of Judges, chapter 6, 7 and 8. And I suppose in general terms it's the story of a weak man who was made strong. You read these chapters for yourself sometime during this week. Chapters 6, 7 and 8. And consider Gideon. Consider the kind of things that he said. Remember, the story begins with Gideon hiding in a cave to thrash the grain. Scared to do it out in the open in case somebody saw him and the spies would report and the Midianites would come. And then when the angel of the Lord appeared to him, there was an outburst of complaint. It's all God's fault. Oh, we've heard all this about the God of Abraham, praise and all that kind of thing, but where is he? What's he doing for us nowadays? Wasn't a very nice man, was Gideon. And his spiritual life wasn't in very good condition. And the story of Gideon is the story of a weak man made strong. A weak man made strong and used by God for the salvation of the nation. Oh, yes, you say, it's a great story. Yes. Put it like this. There was a work of God established. The congregation of God's people was restored to spiritual fellowship with God. And then the minister fell into the hands of the devil as a result of pride. That's the story of Gideon. And it makes me scared. I took the trouble to look back the congregational record away back to August 1980, and I was reading there the daily reading note on Gideon. I commend it to you. The whole story is the story of how an unpromising man became a man of faith. And in the hand of God he did mighty work, whereby the whole nation, the whole people of God, the whole church of God was restored to spiritual vitality. And then because this man, who was apart from the grace of God a weak man, and a weak personality, and because the man became self-centered and proud, he undermined, spiritually speaking, the very work that he had built. But I must confess to you that that's not the emphasis in the 11th chapter of Hebrews. The emphasis there is on the faith of Gideon. And the story as we read it through is obviously the story of how a man was weaned and encouraged and disciplined away from weak self-confidence to trust in God. But if you look with me briefly, and our time is flying past at some of the verses, you'll see the highlights of the story. In chapter 6 at verse 12, it says, the angel of the Lord appeared to him. The whole story begins not with Gideon wanting to be a man of God, but with God choosing Gideon. You've heard me say before that when I was a youngster, I didn't want to be a minister. It wasn't my choice. And God chose Gideon. But if you look at the previous verse, verse 11, the angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, as his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress to hide it from the mid. You see, everything was cut. The whole nation was demoralized. We don't really understand this in our country because it's so long since our country was overrun. But you ask the people who live in the continent of Europe what it was like when the whole place was overrun by the Germans. You knew then what it was to hide what you were doing. And if you had anything or were doing anything, you made it your business to keep it out of sight. Because if you were seen, it could possibly mean immediate death. Now Israel was demoralized like that, and Gideon was hiding. And there he was with his stick, threshing his wheat, and doing it as quietly as possible so that he wouldn't make any noise, nobody would hear him, there wouldn't be any dust of the chaff going up to be seen. It was a terrible state. It's an awful thing when a nation becomes demoralized. And Gideon was hiding from the enemy. Not only demoralized, but I think resigned to hopelessness. And at verse 13, Gideon said to the angel, "Pray, sir." You can imagine how caustic his voice was. "Pray, sir." Mind you, I don't think I would have had the courage to speak to an angel like this. Maybe it's a sign of how far back Gideon had backslidden, that he was able to speak to the messenger of the Lord like this. "Pray, sir. If the Lord is with us, why then has all this befallen us? And where are all his wonderful deeds which our fathers recounted to us, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt? And now the Lord has cast us off and given us into—'" He's a fine God. Now that's Gideon, who gets mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 as a hero of faith. It's all God's fault. Said Gideon, you know the kind of language. "We've prayed and prayed and prayed, but God hasn't heard. God's let us down." And then we come to verses 14 to 16 of that chapter, which is the story of Gideon's commission. And Gideon's reply, Lord, you've got it wrong. I'm just a poor thing, Lord." And the Lord might well have said, "I know that, chum. You don't need to tell me." But you know, when people say, I'm just a poor thing, they get very cross if you agree with them. And psychologically, that's the best thing to do. Because they don't really mean it. When they say, I'm a poor thing, they want, no, you mustn't say that about yourself. But I think the angel of the Lord agreed with Gideon. I'm just a poor thing. And then verse 17, Gideon said, Lord, if I found favor, if all this is real, if you're not pulling my leg, are you, Lord? If all this is real, show me a sign that it's really you that's speaking with me. In his weakness of faith, he asked for a sign, and he got it. God, what a God we have. God came down to Gideon's level. We call it a children's hymn. It's nothing of the sort. It begins, where is it? "Great God, and wilt thou condescend to be my father?" Yes, says God. I'll come right down beside you. And that's what he did with Gideon, and Gideon got the sign. We didn't read about it, but he got the sign. But then if you look down to verse 22, then Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord, and Gideon said, "Alas, O Lord God, for now I have seen the angel." I've seen God, I'm going to die. Do you see what was happening? In weakness of faith, he asked for a sign, and God condescended and came down to his level and gave him a sign, and after the sign, his faith was still as weak as ever. And then God began to lead Gideon forward into faith. And at verse 25, that night the Lord said to Gideon, "Go and destroy your father's favorite idolatrous shrine." And Gideon might well have said, oh, I'm scared of my father. Gideon could say, Lord, if I do this to his altar and his Asherah and all that claptrap of idolatry, he'll be furious. And then Gideon swallowed hard because he realized that God was in earnest. That night the Lord said, down you go. Do you see what is being said in verses 25 and 26? Gideon, you're going to do great things for the nation in my hand. Now I want you to go and start the reformation at home. And at home, get rid of the things at home that are coming between you and God. Now I've written down in my notes here, did Gideon's parents realize that they were standing in the way of their son's usefulness to God? Isn't that an awful thought? Fathers and mothers here tonight, are we standing in the way of the usefulness of our children in God's service? And are we that kind of hindrance because there are things in our personal lives and in our home life and in our workaday life that shouldn't be there because they're an offense to God? Gideon knew that the cost of the thing he was being asked to do, and he wasn't brave enough to do it during the day, so he did it at night. And you can imagine how he trembled as he waited for the dawning of the day. But when the day dawned, so it says in chapter 6, verse 31, and when Gideon's father saw what had been done to his idolatrous altar, instead of blowing up, Gideon's father was converted. Yes, it's there. And Gideon's father took a public stand against all his colleagues in society. We're not told what Gideon's reaction to that was. I think perhaps he had been delighted. But then verse 33 tells us that the delight was short-lived because the enemy came. But when the enemy came, verse 34, the Spirit of the Lord took possession of Gideon. The Spirit of the Lord clothed himself with Gideon. And of course that signifies that all the marvelous things that were then going to be done were being done by the mighty Spirit of God, but to everybody who saw it, it appeared as if it was Gideon. The Spirit of the Lord put Gideon on like a jacket or a coat. Oh, you could preach a whole sermon about that alone. The Spirit of God took possession of Gideon. But look at verse 36. Then Gideon said to God, If thou wilt deliver Israel by my hand as thou hast said, behold, I want a sign. He was still full of doubt, still full of fears. And he was given a sign. If there is some dew on the fleece and it's dry on the ground. All right, said God, you want a sign, I'll give you a sign. And when Gideon took up the fleece, it wasn't damp. It was sopping wet, and he wrung out a whole bowl of water. And the ground round about was dry. He got his sign. Did that help his faith? No. He asked for another sign. He said, now God, tomorrow do it the other way round. Gideon said, "Don't be angry, God. I know I'm doubting you, but give me another sign. And I'm moved to the very depth of my being by realizing that God came down to Gideon's level yet again. And in my heart of hearts there is a voice saying, I, George Philip, how often over the years has God come down to your level? And he has. To quench my doubts and my fears and to reassure me again and again. But I wish, oh how I wish, that I had risen more nobly in faith to trust a God like this, rather than always to have to be reassured and reassured. But you know, when we go on into chapter 7, and we must draw to a close, and we will, the story makes it evident that Gideon was still far too man-centered. That's the terrible snare, you know. We all want to be thought well of by people. We all want to be successful in the eyes of people. That's why so often we want bigger and bigger congregations. And God said to Gideon, your congregation's far too big. And he reduced it. God said, Gideon, you've got such a mighty army that I can't work. I mentioned in the scripture reading, chapter 7, verse 2, the Lord said to Gideon, the people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, my own hand has delivered me. And we're told, I think, if you look at verse 3 carefully and do your sums, you will see that Gideon had an army of some 32,000. And then in chapter 8 at verse 10, if you do your sums there or look at that there, you will see that the Midianites had an army of 135,000. Well, that's the odds of 5 to 1 against Gideon. But you know, odds like that are reasonable still for a nation, especially a Jewish nation that is fighting for its survival and with their God to help them. And it seems that Gideon wasn't too perturbed. He said, all right, God, if you're with us and we've got 32,000, they've got 135, but our God is with us. We'll easily smite the 135. But God said, no. You would be proud if you succeeded like that. And God said, first of all, in verse 3, let everybody who is fearful and trembling go way back home. And 22,000 went back and 10,000 remained. So that was 10,000 against 135,000. And Gideon might say, well, now, God, that's reasonable, isn't it? Ah, says God, but we are not dealing in reason, we are dealing in faith. Too many. And they were reduced to 300 men against 135,000. That's an odds of 450 to 1 against Israel. And Gideon stood his ground. And look down to chapter 7 at verse 9. The Lord said, arise and go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you're still afraid. And the rest of the story indicates that Gideon was still afraid. Well, who wouldn't be afraid? 300 fighting men against 135,000. Go down and spy. And Gideon went down. I've a sympathy for Gideon. The army of the Midianites, like locusts, they were everywhere. And Gideon and his few spies crept up, and then they overheard. Chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. You know, the Midianite had a dream. And the other Midianite was, I can explain your dream. Oh, it's obvious. This is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the man, and into his hand God has given Midian and all the host. And Gideon thought, they're more afraid than I am. And he thought, God has done that. And I could have imagined God saying, well, Gideon, you didn't think I would make a mess of planning this whole thing, did you? And then we have the story of the 300 men surrounding the Midianites, and the torches covered with the jars and all that kind of thing. And then at the crucial moment, the shout, and they broke the pitchers, and the whole army of Midian suddenly realized, you know, in the dark of the night, blazing light right round the whole of their army, and this colossal shout. And I don't think anybody can quite shout like Joe's, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And it was all over. It was panic. And it had all been pre-prepared. And I can imagine Gideon saying, why did I doubt and fear? Why did I not trust God right from the beginning? Why, after all these tokens of his mercy and goodness, why did I keep on doubting and doubting and doubting? Oh, said Gideon, I should have had faith. Well, he had faith. And the victory was won, and in chapter 8 at verse 28 we are told that the land had rest for 40 years, in the days of Gideon. And that's the story of what God can do with such poor material. I'm back to the deaconess booklet, and God prepared a worm. But I will be unfaithful to you and to God, I and to myself, if I didn't remind you that the future of the children of Israel had already been undermined by Gideon. Because in the making of the ephod and placing it in a particular place like a shrine in his own town, Gideon made Gideon the focus of the people of God. And he took their eyes from God to Gideon. And in due time he took their hearts from God to Gideon. Yes, the story of Gideon tells us what God can do with a very ordinary, unpromising person. But the story also tells us of the tremendous danger of pride. And if you ever get too concerned about your minister, or too much taken up with him, or too much taken up with the name of Sandyford and all that it stands for, then you and I will have betrayed our trust. And it may well be, and we'll speak of this tomorrow night at the Kirk session, it may well be that God is reducing us as a congregation. Our membership is almost down to the 300. It may be that God is reducing us in order that he might use us. And when I think of God using us in days to come, my heart says, oh, please God, teach us to have faith. Amen, and may God bless to us his word.